Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Jennifer Yerimeyeva. I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that if I asked you what your favorite Romanian dish is, you might struggle to answer. Well, to address this egregious problem, I'm delighted to welcome Irina Georgescu to the podcast today to talk about her new book, Carpathia, Food from the Heart of Romania, which is out this week from Interlink Books. We are recording this during the initial week of global social isolation due to the coronavirus, and I personally can't think of a better way to pass the time at home than by cooking your way through this marvelous book, filled with lovely photographs, delectable spreads, wonderful salads, rich soups, main courses, and sweet desserts. I'm so pleased that I have the opportunity to learn more about the cuisine of Romania, which brings together so many different influences from Ottoman to Russian. And I'm really looking forward to talking with Irina about the book and her work as a chef and food writer. Irina, welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, tell us, and to begin with, tell us a little bit about your own story and how you came to be a food writer.
Yes, well, I think that I've always loved food, you know, even when I was little and how I had no idea how to cook or even to read, I loved organizing my mom's handwritten recipes. You know, she used to keep them in an old chocolate box. So I used to go through them and put them in whatever order I thought it was right. So, and later on, you know, I would help my mom to shop at the market, to prep in the kitchen, to cook with her. You know, it was just a way to be together and to actually... I loved being around her, so I wanted to be there with her in the kitchen. So we always talked about food, you know, even when we didn't have much around, especially during, you know, communist regime, and especially towards the end of the communist regime was quite difficult. But then when I moved to the UK 11 years ago, so not a very long time ago, you know, I actually left behind a career in marketing, and in the UK, I had the opportunity to nurture my passion for writing about food and for cooking. And basically, I found that cooking my mom's food and Romanian food was a way to stay connected with my family and with my homeland, and it was quite nostalgic in a way. So all of a sudden, I realized that I was talking about Romanian food quite a lot. So I built a website and I started to connect with people on social media. And, you know, bit by bit, you know, I didn't think that people would be interested in what I had to say about Romanian food. But luckily they were. And the idea of the book came as a result of this interest, and then I looked around and on, you know, social media and on internet, and I realized that I couldn't find too many people outside of Romania talking about and or writing about Romanian cuisine. So when I started, and even today, the cookbooks market was steadily shaping a culinary map of the world, and Romania wasn't on it. You know, Romania wasn't there, And I mean,
well, that's terrible.
I mean, yes, well, I mean, it was, but it wasn't there at the standard of what we expect today from a cookery book. So I thought that was a pity, that was a shame. And because, you know, we have a beautiful country. It's full of resources and full of traditions. And you've seen in the book, you know, everything is connected to food and comes back to food all the time. And there is a strong story here that needs to be told. And I was very lucky to find, you know, a literary agent interested in my proposal. And obviously, together we found a publisher interested in Romanian food. And it was very lucky to be able to find this team and bring this team together to work on it and publish it today. But, you know, the timing is
fantastic.
Probably not necessarily right, like you said. But hopefully people will have more time to read because the book is also about Romanian traditions and about a bit about my family as well. And it's also about a bit of history of Romania and how we eat the way we eat now. And so it's more than just cookery. So even if someone doesn't go out there to buy the ingredients to cook, you know, there is still a lot to read and to learn about Romania.
There certainly is. This is first of all, a very beautiful book. I think everybody who's seen the cover is really struck by its just really physicality. For our listeners who may not be as familiar with Romania, let's dive into the title. You've called your book Carpathia, and I wonder if you can take us into the Carpathians and set the stage for us and explain why you chose this title.
Yes. It was very easy to choose this in a way. You know, I just didn't want to go necessarily with Romania. I could have, you know, said this is the title, Romania. But actually what defines Romania very much are the Carpathian Mountains. They are imposing, you know, they are an imposing element in our country, landscape as well. And they create the main regions of the country. And also they create their own microclimates, and I would say microhistory as well, because you will see also in the book that in the south of the mountains, in the east of the mountains, so what it is in the south of Valachian Plain and what's in the east of Moldova, we were under the Ottoman Empire for centuries. So our food is very much influenced by Greek and Turkish cuisine. And the way we eat and the way, you know, we use the same kind of similar words and the way we prepare the food, you know, we like this little small plates at the beginning of a meal, you know, very much like Meze Greek style of eating and mixing dips and salads and, you know, bread and charcuterie. You know, this is a very, very Greek, very Turkish way of starting a meal. But then you cross the mountains in what it is now Transylvania. It's the middle of the country. It's surrounded by the Carpathian Mountains. And we were under the Habsburg Empire, the Austrian Empire, Hungarian Empire there for centuries. So our food there is very, you know, German, you know, Saxon, Austrian. We love, you know, potatoes. We love paprika, exactly like the in Hungarian cuisine. We love dumplings, we love noodles, especially in sweet dishes. I mean, that's really very comfort food, you know, when you know, the weather is bad, then you really need like really nice food for the soul. So you see that is still related to the Carpathian Mountains. And then we have, you know, in the west as well, in the Banat region, that is a real, to use a cliche, a real melting pot of everything that happened in Romania, history-wise as well and migration-wise. So, the Carpathian Mountains have an impact on our cuisine, and you know, it's if you think of, let's say how shepherds make cheese during the summer months in those remote huts on top of the mountains. And how that air and the environment influence the flavor and the quality of the milk, you know, that is again related to the what people call today terroir. You know, what Carpathian mountains give to, in terms of flavor to the ingredients. But then you go, you come back from the mountains in very like hilly regions, and you have a lot of like fruit trees and walnut trees and chestnut trees, and they love the rolling slopes of the Carpathian hills. So we cook a lot of fruit, even in savory dishes as well. Mm-hmm. So that is another influence of the Carpathian. And just to mention, because the book is more about food and not necessarily about wine, but all these microclimates made by the Carpathian Mountains create some beautiful Romanian wines, and especially in Transylvania, it's just a variety. The variety is incredible. But also because you will see that there is a little chapter in the book about fish, and mm-hmm. I should have put more in there, but in Romania we eat a lot of freshwater fish, and it's because we have so many rivers. And the almighty river is the Danube, and the Danube Delta. So the Danube actually creates a natural border in the south of the country between Romania and Bulgaria. So it comes from the, if you look at the map of Romania, it comes from the west, from Serbia, and crosses the country in the south from west to east. So it's just a very long area, a very long river in the country. So it also creates a vast plains, and sometimes there are marshlands. And if you're thinking back in history, those marshlands were turned into rice fields by Italian farmers in the 17th century because they were so fertile. So and then the river creates the delta, and that is the Danube Delta is a UNESCO site, and we're very proud of this. And the diversity of everything is incredible, you know. And mm-hmm. and then the river enters the Black Sea. So our cuisine is in the south of the Carpathian Mountains, and you know, between the mountains and the delta, you know, it's all about freshwater fish. So it's carp, it's bream, pike, trout. I mean, we have a wonderful way to prepare trout that we catch in the rivers. We put them in between pine branches, and we cold smoke them. So, the pine just imparts such a beautiful flavor to the fish, and it's just an amazing way to prepare it. And then you just eat it as any smoked fish, you know. So
lovely.
It's very, very, very good. And also, you see, in the Danube Delta, people eat only fish. And, you know, you can look at one of our national dishes, the meatball soup that we have in the country. So in the north or in the mountains, you make that soup with pork or pork and beef. You make the meatballs, you make the broth, and you add a lot of lavage as well. Well, in the Danube, you make the same thing, but with fish. So there are fish balls in the soup, you know. So
fantastic.
This is how the Carpathian Mountains play such an important role, you know, not only in history, but in our cuisine as well. So this is why the title is Carpathia.
Uh-huh. And you've just did a wonderful description of the geography, but this is also the crossroads of many, many different kinds of civilizations. And you touched on that with the different empires that Romania was part of. But I love the point you made in the book where you said that in the summer, Romanians eat in a very sort of Greek and Turkish way, whereas in the winter, you turn to the more Slavic and Germanic traditions. And I wonder if you could go through some of the dishes that characterize that trend.
Yes. This is the case with probably most countries which have a continental climate. In Romania, the winters are very cold, especially in the countryside, well, and especially in the mountains. And, you know, sometimes the winter starts and it's very, you know, it's full of snow. It starts in at the end of October, and in the mountains they finish in May. So obviously you need very hearty food, you know, where you need food to keep you alive, you know, to give you enough energy to go through this harsh winters. So
I see.
Yeah, so we go to mm-hmm. we love, obviously, we love slow cooked stews, and we cook with lard, you know, because we rear our own pigs and we slaughter the pig in December, which is quite a tradition back home. So we have this homemade lard that we use instead of butter or instead of oil. We love, you know, our butter bean stew with the ham hock, and we love pork scratchings as well that we make at home, and we eat all these with fermented green tomatoes and fermented sauerkraut, cabbage, that we also make at home. So because we have this tradition of pickling and fermenting ingredients. We also love to obviously cook with potatoes and, as I said, dumplings and noodles. So it's very much this type of a stew, you know, a slow cooked casserole that's something that is really comforting. And we eat a lot of polenta with it in many ways, not just the creamy polenta that people are used to see, but also we make a polenta bread that we cut it, the slices, as we slice bread. So it's just more of a set polenta. We make polenta fritters with cheese in the middle. So it's very satisfying food, you know, when especially when it's very cold outside. And then after a few months, you have these very hot summers. And you go, wow, what am I going to do? I can't be in the house. So, right. So obviously people take their kitchens outside. So we have outside kitchen, outdoors kitchens, you know, whether it's there are just under a roof or just in the garden or in the shade of a big tree, or, you know, it's, we cook outside. So that means that the flavors are more like instant flavors. They're the flavors of grilling meat and slicing vegetables to make a salad. So
right, and those wonderful spreads that you begin the book with. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those, because those are definitely bookmarked for me for the next few months. Nah. They just look wonderful.
Yes, I mean, in the summer, when the first aubergines of the season are on the market, you know, or in the gardens, you know, we just char grill them on the barbecue, and then we peel the skin off, and we just add oil and onion, and this is the dip. I mean, it's nothing complicated. Of course, some people have different recipes. They add mayo, or they can add a bit of sour cream, or, you know, they can add zucchini, depends, you know. So, but this, the salad, the aubergine salad, the aubergine dip, is a staple dish. And we call it salata de vinete. And it's so good. And we always eat it with tomatoes, and always eat it with the charred pepper salad, which is served with a garlic vinaigrette, which again is called mujdei. And mujdei is something that everybody makes, and in a way everybody loves, because we eat it in so many dishes. And this is a garlic vinaigrette.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, and it's the garlic. We eat a lot of garlic. I think this is something, the staple ingredient in our cuisine, and it's very healthy.
And what about spices? You've mentioned the paprika from the Habsburg Empire, like Hungary. What other spices are key in your pantry?
Well, I think paprika is quite one of the most important one. We put it in almost everything. I mean, we make, and there is a recipe in the book about a leg of mutton, because we eat a lot of mutton as well. We call pastrama, and the pastrama is something that you cure over a few months. Well, in my book, I just put a recipe when you just make a marinade. But the key is the paprika. And also we put paprika in sausages and in a lot of charcuterie, but we put it in stews, whether vegetable stews or with meat. So this is quite an important spice. But also we like herbs quite a lot. So and winter and the summer savory is one of the herbs we have, which is kind of between rosemary and thyme. You know, it's a bit one of those, but actually it's not quite rosemary and it's not quite thyme either. So it's winter or summer savory, depending on the season. We like those. And we like also a lot of dill and parsley. And I mentioned it before, lovage. So lovage is one of our favorite dishes, herbs.
And that just grows like a weed, doesn't it? I mean, I have some in my garden that gets up to like 3 feet tall in the summertime.
Yes.
So it's a wonderful kind of crispy, like almost like a celery. Yes. But it's completely of itself, I think.
Yes, yes. And it's very, very good. And obviously it's not pretentious. So you can just have it and leave it there in the garden and then just come back year after year. And it's very nice. And we use quite a lot of it. And tarragon as well, because they are a bit, you know, kind of the same flavors. So tarragon as well is very nice. So that's why I used it in my mackerel, smoked mackerel salad. And that's another very popular salad in Romania. So I added more tarragon than usual, and I made a mayo as well.
I love tarragon. I think it's one of the most underappreciated herbs in the United States, because I think people don't know what to do with it. But it just adds like this just burst of lovely flavor that complements so many things like fish.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
And also I use it in one recipe with an apricot cake. If you put a bit of tarragon on top, you will be surprised.
Delicious.
Yes. Yeah.
That sounds fantastic. Now, also another big part of your book deals with something called, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, borscht.
Yes.
Borscht. And I think for our listeners, this is maybe not something they're accustomed to, but walk us through what borscht is and how you use it.
Yes. So borscht, first of all, is an ingredient for us. So I know many mm-hmm. people, when they hear borscht, they think of the Russian beetroot soup.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably comes from there. But our borscht is, first of all, as I said, an ingredient. And you prepare it by fermenting wheat bran with cornmeal. And you put some lovage in there, or you put dill, or you put anything you like to, in terms of aromatics, to put it in there to give it more flavor. Or some people just keep it very, very simple, and they make a borscht only from wheat bran. So you put all these ingredients in a big jar and you put water on top, and then you wait to ferment. So depending on where you are in the world, this can happen in a few days or it can happen in 2 weeks, like it happens here in the UK. but it has, at the end, it just separates, obviously. It separates. Everything goes in terms of the wheat bran and the cornmeal, it's at the bottom of the jar, and the liquid is on top, and you can see this beautiful greenish yellowish very clear liquid. And when you taste it, it has a very pleasant, quite sweet taste, but also tangy, but not tangy as a lemon, so don't expect that. More tangy as a more like a tomato type of tanginess. So quite mm-hmm. mild. And obviously, if you want to keep it for longer, it will ferment even more. But I think it will be too strong. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a flexible recipe, like with everything. You know, you just need to experiment a bit and taste and see what you like and how you like it. So we take this, we strain this, we put this liquid, and we use the liquid first of all to create what we call in Romania a borscht. And this borscht is actually a clear broth. So it can be meat or it can be vegetable broth. And then towards the end of a cooking, we add, let's say, 300 ml or 500 ml of this borscht, the ingredient, the fermented liquid, just to add more tanginess. But also it's a very healthy way to eat meaty dishes. Nowadays people talk about how good fermented food is for you. So that's why so many people started to do kimchi at home or kombucha or on these kind of things. And obviously miso. So they are all part, including borscht, they are all part of the same family of fermented foods. So this is a very traditional way to to eat meat broth and vegetable broth. So when we say borscht at home, we actually need to say beef borscht or lettuce mm-hmm. borscht or chicken borscht, or because, and that means that it is sour. So if you use borscht, then it has to be called a borscht if you use the ingredient. But if you don't use borscht, because you can sour this broth with something else, like vinegar, if you don't want to go through the whole like 2 weeks of waiting, you add vinegar, or you add tomatoes because they are tangy as well, or mm-hmm. you add lemon if you like. So if you don't use necessarily the borscht itself and you use other souring ingredient, you call it chorba. And you know, again, that if you say chorba, then it is a sour soup or broth, actually. It is a mm-hmm. sour broth, but it's not with borscht. It has something else in it, another yes. souring ingredient. So this is how we use borscht, first of all. But very often, and how I do it even here in the UK, even if I don't make anything with borscht, like a soup, I drink it in the morning. I have a glass of it, and it's very pleasant. And especially in the summer, we have it. It's a little bit salty and a little bit tangy, and it's perfect for hot days. So I drink that. But some people, for instance, they use the fermented leftover wheat bran and cornmeal, and they make like a face mask because it's very good for the skin. Yes. Or if you have a very dry hair, then you make a hair mask. It is just very, very good because we use everything from it. And yes, it's
that's such fantastic.
The skin is so glowing after that. It's beautiful. If I can
Who
wear
knew?
It all the time.
Who knew? Well, this is a perfect. This book is perfect for the coronavirus self isolation because you don't need much, and you can take care of all your beauty problems as well as learning a new cuisine. So it's perfect. And one of the big ingredients that comes through in your book sort of shines through is actually your family. It seems like everyone in your family is obsessed with food and does something about food. You have an uncle who actually raises pigs, and you have grandparents who've bequeathed you these amazing dishes. And tell us a little bit about your family. Obviously, your mother was a huge influence on this book, but how else did your family sort of come together to celebrate food?
Well, yes. We all had to contribute to actually have some food on the table, especially when I grew up. And I know I mentioned it before, but I'll come back to it very briefly. I grew up during communist times. And in those times, we just didn't have ingredients to buy. Very often, and especially towards the end of the regime, the food was rationed. So we only had, let's say, 1 kilo of flour per family of four, or 2 kilos of 2 liters of oil, and I don't know, one packet of butter. So so we had to come up with different ways to have food on the table. So when we had, when the summers were really good and, you know, late autumns, we really had to spend time together to preserve the food we had in at the market at that point. So making all the jams, the compotes, because these were food for later on in the winter and spring. Because in spring, it's still kind of you don't have enough on the market to, in terms of ingredients, seasonal ingredients. So you still have to eat from your, you know, winter jam and the compote and everything, and the preserves and the dips and everything, and putting aubergines in jars, you know, to have later to make an aubergine stew or something. So we all had to contribute. We all had to help mom to go to the market and, you know, carry home, you know, the ingredients. And it's quite a process when you pickle and when you make jams, you know, to sterilize the jars, to, you know, and we all had to work together, you know, dad and my sister and I. And so, because also at the same time, my dad and my mom, they had their own jobs. So it wasn't just that they were at home and preserving and pickling all these kind of things that we had. they went to work, and also they worked on Saturdays because of that. Those times they had a 5 week working week. I don't know, 5 day working week. Sorry. So they worked on a Saturday as well. So it was quite hard, you know. So food was always something that we had in our mind, you know. So for instance, especially when I was coming back from school, sometimes I was queuing to get to buy meat or butter or whatever, you know, because it wasn't in the shops. It wasn't mm-hmm. just every now and then. So we really had to be quick. my uncle in Transylvania, he was called Antone. So from Antoine, probably. So Antone was quite a character. I think he actually looked after his farm animals better than after his children. Yes. I mean, because they were more important, you know, the farm animals. In those times, the farmers weren't really farmers because everything was nationalized. So it belonged to the state. So he didn't really have loads of pigs or loads of cows or sheep. He only had, you know, one cow, a few pigs, a few sheep, and, you know, one horse, because he wasn't allowed to have more than that. And every year he reared a pig for us. And that was really like a lifeline thrown to us, because in the cities, you can't really grow your own. You know, you have a mm-hmm. little balcony. You probably can actually have some tomatoes or herbs, but not necessarily chicken and pigs, you know. So he used to rear this pig for us. And every December, we used to go there and be part of this tradition to slaughter the pig. And in 2 days, everything was prepared from nose to tail. Everything from that pig was turned into sausages or salamis or leberwurst or some sort of a black pudding that we make at home as well, and lardo, and, you know, the cured pork fat and lard as well. We used to take home almost everything, you know, just leave a little bit to him to cure for other months, and then he was sending them by post. But we took all the sausages back home, you know, to the apartment, and it was like a little apartment in Bucharest where we lived, probably 40 square meters, like tiny. Kitchen was tiny. I mean, you couldn't be like two people in there. It was too much already, you know. So yes, it was, my uncle was very important to us, as you can imagine. But, you know, also my grandmothers, one of them, the one that is from the south, my dad's mom, she loved shortcuts, you know. She loved very frugal dishes, you know. She liked, for instance, the fruit stew thickened with polenta that we usually made when the fruit was in season. So that was a sort of a soup and dessert at the same time, so one meal in two kind of thing. So
perfect, yeah.
Yes, that's why she was really quick, and she loved to make flatbreads, and you know, she was just serving them with yogurt or fruit again, you know, just to make to give us something to eat when she had us around. But also she had that kind of, she used to give us a very thin polenta when we didn't feel very well. It's very thin, very hot, like a drink, but she put butter on top to make it a bit fatty. So we actually drank that and then went to bed, and we were fine after that, you know. So she had this kind of tricks. But later on, when we were, you know, old enough to be able to drink alcohol, she used to kind of make a sort of a mulled brandy with pepper in it, you know. So, or a very strong coffee with rum in it, and give that to us. So that was very good. She was really popular. We loved her for that, for those drinks. But then the other grandmother, my mom's mom, she was from Transylvania. My mom was from Transylvania. So my grandmother had a different approach to food and to cooking. The food she cooked needed time. So, you know, she used to cook in layers and, you know, to slow cook stuff. She used to make for us, our own ricotta style cheese that we call Brinza de Vache. So that was a ricotta style cow's milk cheese. And she used to make it at home for us. So she makes sure that we had the freshest cheese and not the one that was available in the shops. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we used to make beautiful confitures with her. And so, you know, she had another influence with us. She made her own noodles, because I used to love noodles with sugar. So she made her own noodles and like strudel dough as well. She used to stretch that dough on the table in the living room, because it was massive. You know, it was very, it looks a lot of it's very thin dough, but very large. So yes, but also, as I said, my dad was also involved in cooking. He was looking always after the pickles and after the sauerkraut cabbage. He also was the one who used to make plum brandy and the sour cherry liqueur. So it's not only a woman, it wasn't only a woman's task to be in the kitchen or to prepare food. You know, men had their own things to do in this picture.
All hands on deck.
Yes, absolutely.
How did that change after sort of the end of the communist period? Was there an era that I lived in Russia just as things were ending, and suddenly everyone wanted sushi or Italian food, and it was very strange because you know, nobody wanted to cook borscht or cabbage soup or anything. Everybody wanted different kinds of exotic food. But then that pendulum swung back. And I wonder if it's the same in Romania.
Yes, I think it is. I think that obviously after the communist times, we just had a lot of ingredients on the market and a lot of things to buy. We just didn't have the money, so
right,
the other way around. But yes, we started to have, you know, the Chinese and Indian restaurants, and then Lebanese as well, because that's very much how we eat anyway. And the Greek restaurants, and then obviously the Italians, and now we have Swedish restaurants as well. So it's a very diverse market, you know, at the moment. But we Romanians, we love very much our traditional food. So you will find a lot of traditional restaurants in Romania. Mm-hmm. And it's not just for tourists, it's for Romanians. We go and eat the traditional food, and it's served in the traditional way. So nobody thinks of deconstructing a cabbage roll, for instance, because there is no point in that. We like it the way it is, you know, and it's a very down-to-earth approach to our traditional food. And in a way, it's a very good thing, because it means that it preserves our traditions instead of trying to change something that actually is delicious as it is, you know.
Right.
But there is also, you know, this trend of fast food, of course, like in every country, crisps and ready meals and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm happy to see that the traditional restaurants are still there, and it means that we still love our traditions quite a lot. So that is a good thing.
And it sounds as though there's always been an interest or a focus on sort of locavore organic just by necessity, that perhaps now is becoming the preferred way to source food.
Yes, that is true, yes. But also, you see, when you go to supermarkets, you know, when I go home, I go to the market and I go to supermarkets to just see what's going on. So sadly, I can see the same flavorless tomatoes in the shops, you know, like in the UK. But then I go to the market and I found those tomatoes that I used to eat when I was little. And now they are called Romanian tomatoes. And that means they are local tomatoes, which is really good.
I am such a tomato snob. I just don't even think about eating them from, say, October through May. There's just no point.
Yes.
I don't even consider them. So the biggest thing I miss about living in Russia is the tomatoes, actually.
Yes, they have a different flavor, and they are
a very different flavor.
And they are like sweet, like melons. They're just so nice.
Indeed.
Yes, so I miss those too. And even if I try to grow them here, and I have a little greenhouse as well. So even in the greenhouse in the UK, the flavor is not there. I don't know why they don't get probably enough light or enough heat. I don't know.
And tell me, is in the UK, I mean, there's so many different nationalities living in the UK. Is there an interest in Romanian cuisine in the way that I know there's the Polish cuisine has really taken root, as has Russian? How about Romanian cuisine?
It's starting now, and I'm glad to see, you know, I have to say that finding someone to publish some Romanian cookery book was a challenge, because in the UK especially, we're not known for our cuisine. So it was a challenge. However, looking at the food media, they've just welcomed it so you know, wholeheartedly. It's just a pleasure to see how intrigued they are, and they want to find out more. So I think this will contribute to a rising popularity of Romanian cuisine, and also hopefully it will inspire more Romanians who live abroad to actually start cooking Romanian and talk about Romanian cuisine to their friends, you know, even if they don't buy the book. It's not about that. It is about being proud of our traditions and of our own cuisine. And if we actually look back at our traditional cuisine, it's very much uses the ingredients of how we eat today, in terms of, look at gluten-free. I mean, polenta, cornmeal is gluten-free. Look at our butter bean hummus, that it's also in the book. You know, we use less oil than in a chickpea hummus, and we don't use tahini oil. But we use less oil because we emulsify it with the butter bean water. So, and that creates a really smooth dip, but that's really healthy as well. So
absolutely.
Yeah, so I like this kind of thing, to actually look back at what is traditional, because I think that our ancestors and our grandparents, you know, the way they cooked and the way they ate, they knew better than we know now. So we should have some information from there.
And one of the wonderful things about the book comes at the end, when you list, we sort of take us through some of the traditions and seasonality and even superstitions that are part of the culture and it, like that part of the cuisine. I wonder if you can just touch on a few of those as we finish up.
Yes, we are. We have a lot of superstitions. I mean, I can write a book about it, actually.
There you go.
No. It's, yes, everything is very related. It comes back to nature all the time, you know, and we are part of this nature. And you even, let's take, for instance, our polenta, you know, the polenta cornbread, the what we call mamaliga. Sometimes when you bake it or when you cook it, it cracks. So you know if you see that, if you see the crack on top, you will make a long journey. This is what it means. So it's very interesting how it's very playful when you look at food like that. Or also related to polenta, you know, so let's say you turn it onto the table, the polenta bread, and then you have that the pan where you cooked it. You put a bit of water in it and then you drink it. And that means that you will mend a broken heart, you know.
Ah.
So, yeah, it's still very funny. So, you know, garlic, for instance, is very much part of superstitions. On St. Andrew's Day, well, on the night before St. Andrew's Day, we eat a lot of garlic just to be protected. Because otherwise, you know, the evil spirits would be around us. And also
when is St. Andrew's Day?
Is it not just the end of November?
Okay.
Yes. 30th. End of November. So there's really kind of a zombie night. So you eat garlic. But at the same time, let's say when we have our St. Valentine's Day, which is on the 24th of February, we sometimes eat garlic, or we eat a very salty garlic bread, so we can dream during the night who our husband would be, because the husband will bring us some water in the dream.
That's marvelous. That's great.
And again, in springtime, just to celebrate renewal and everything, women in the countryside just tend to put a bit of dough when they make bread to stick it on fruit trees so they can have a very good year. So that's a very, very nice thing to feed the nature somehow, you know, to look after after the nature around you. That's right. Really nice. And just to mention at the end, because I can't really just not mention it, because we love coffee and we drink a lot of Turkish-style coffee. And we do a lot of fortune-telling, you know, after we drink the coffee, we turn the cup and we kind of look at different shapes, you know, and it's really, really interesting. And my grandmother, the one from the south, my dad's mom, she used to be famous in the village for being a good fortune teller, just looking at the coffee of the coffee cup after you drank the coffee. So here we go.
I'm sure she could have predicted that her granddaughter would make a huge success of this book, which I think is really poised to give us a new understanding of this marvelous cuisine that I think the world doesn't know enough about. So thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you so much for reading it.
Absolutely. Tell us, just before we finish, what's next? What's coming up next for you? You'll be working on promoting the book in innovative ways that keep you at home.
Yes, definitely. Well, the thing is, I had quite a few events lined up, but obviously they are not going to happen. But, you know, people are in worse situations at the moment, so I'm not complaining. I'm very active on social media. I have my own website, irinageorgescu.com, and I put loads of recipes there. I talk about Romanian traditions, and I also have a e-newsletter where I send every month exclusive recipes only to my subscribers, so they will not be put on the website. And this is for free, so they can just subscribe, and then every month they will get an email from me. So this is a way to actually create more awareness about Romanian cuisine. You know, I talk about different things, about different traditions, and give different recipes. I mean, the latest newsletter focused on Lent, because we have a lot of Lent days in Romania. Almost half a year is Lent. So obviously we have a lot of vegetarian dishes, and I wanted people to know about that. So this is how I do it at the moment. I obviously, you know, put a lot of on social media as well. I'm very active on Instagram, but you can find the link to Instagram on my website. And this is what I do at the moment. I promote the book. There is a lot of press coverage in the UK at the moment, like National Geographic and Olive Magazine and Delicious Magazine. They are all really... they are featuring Romania, which is great. I feel very honored and humbled by the whole thing. And in terms of what's next, I don't know yet, because, you know, there is a lot to tell about Romanian cuisine, especially because it's not only Romanian, it's a bit German, it's a bit Greek, it's a bit Bulgarian, a bit Serbian, Macedonian. There are all... the entire Eastern Europe is in there. So
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so there is a lot to say about it. So I don't think this will be the only book, but I'm not thinking of anything at the moment new. Yes.
Well, absolutely. Now, this is a wonderful beginning to a discovery of Romanian cuisine. The book is Carpathia. And the wonderful author Irina Georgescu has joined us today on the New Books Network. I assume that Carpathia, Food from the Heart of Romania, is available where all great books are sold.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Good.
Yes,
good.
Exactly.
I encourage our listeners to get a copy, because it's a marvelous book. It does what all good culinary books should do. It not only teaches you how to make great food, but it takes you on a journey into the soul of a country. So, Irina, thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for asking me, for inviting me. Thank you.
And I'll be back soon with another interesting interview with an author and his or her book. Thanks for joining us today.